Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 352, and this is an incredibly exciting one for me. This podcast almost made me call it a day on the podcast, because it's an absolute high. I got hit up on less than 24 hours notice, probably about 5 hours notice, more realistically. Yeah, 5 or 6 hours notice. I got asked if I wanted to jump on Zoom and have an hour with my favourite director of all time, Gaspar Noé. And honestly, I paused over the email. I went to say no because I thought, I've not got time to prepare. You know, if you're going to chat with one of your heroes and someone you'd love to work with at some point, you want to be at your best. But I paused and kind of went, we got to make this happen though, right? So I said yes. I got to preparing. And we jumped on Zoom and we had an amazing chat. And honestly, this one and the Stephen Fry one recently were two that I finished and went, do you reckon I'll draw a line under it there? Because as said, it's the peak. Man, it's mad that I get to do this. I'm so grateful to you lot for listening. Yeah, it's insane to me that this is something I get to do, that I get to have these conversations with these amazing people. And honestly, this went as well as I could have hoped. Gaspar is promoting his new film, Vortex, which is a massive change from his previous films, but, you know, equally amazing, just in different ways and loads of the same ways, but via a different approach, all very vague, but we get into it. Vortex is in cinemas on the 13th of May, and there's an awesome focus on Gaspar Noé and a new French extremity season at the BFI South Bank all throughout May. A lot of you will know I've got mad love for the South Bank. In fact, the current script I'm trying to get made is in many ways a love letter to the South Bank. But that's much of a muchness. I mean, unless there's production companies and whatnot tuning in, because as I recall this, next week I'm going into full pitch mode on this one. And I think it's fucking amazing, genuinely. And you know you don't hear me talking about my scripts and stuff on the podcast. I keep that all very under wraps. But this is a special one, man. I've gone off on a tangent there. Gaspar's amazing. If you're not familiar with him and his work, get down to that South Bank season if you can. Because as you'll hear, I catch all his films in the cinema because I genuinely think it's just a different experience. But all of them I've also watched at home, so I'm a big fan. The first film of Gaspar's I saw was Irreversible, and then Enter the Void, and then Love, and then Climax, featuring previous Distraction Pieces podcast guest, Sophia Bertella. Amazing story about getting her to work on the project in here. Yeah, I'm going to stop rambling on. If you're a fan of directors, I guess, I've had Spike Lee on, I've had everyone. I've had Mangold, I've had McKay, I've had so many good legendary writers and directors. You're talking on the writers' front, we've had Stephen Knight, Kurt Sutter, Kelly Marcel, loads of amazing people, basically. So, but yeah, this one was a special one for me. This one, the email came in and I panicked and then went, nah, let's fucking do it. And then when we finished, I was buzzing. Because he's amazing. He's an inspirational dude. And I genuinely hope he needs a big English man at some point. So, anyway, this is a rambly intro. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Head over there to get merch and goodness. We've just dropped the very limited edition, always selling out gold print versions of the We May Not Be For You and That's Fine sunglasses. We've got loads of good stuff over there, basically. Check it out. You can also catch me on Twitch, acting a fool, twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipyo. I'm doing loads of mad things over there. You might be able to hear a dog snoring in the background. That's Finley. Check him out on Instagram, Finley and B. That's probably all I need to tell you. Patreon, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. But yeah, most importantly, go and catch Vortex in the cinema and catch this whole Gasper season at the South Bank. Honestly, if you can get tickets, if when you hear this, there's still tickets available, catch it, man. There's some amazing stuff being screened. A few things Gasper mentions in this chat are being screened, and yeah, it's dope. I'll be back at the end for a little bit of a wrap-up and a round-up, but for now, this is episode 452 with the man, the myth, the alive by the skin of his teeth, and the grace of gravity, Mr. Gasper Noé.
This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction.
Right, I'm recording now. I'm here today with Gasper Noé. How are you, sir?
Fine, and you?
I'm good. It's been a mad few years for everyone, but kind of extra mad for you with the whole nearly dying thing and all of that. How's that been?
That was the last days of the year 2019.
Yeah.
So I was in a hospital at the beginning of 2020, and then after being there 1 month and the confinement linked to the COVID, 1 year later I went to Buenos Aires to see my dad, and coming back from Buenos Aires I had the idea for this movie. So yeah, it was like a weird year for everybody, the year 2020.
Yeah.
But in my case, when I came out from the hospital, and I was very lucky to have survived to a brain hemorrhage. They said it's just 1% out of 6 who survives without damage.
Wow.
And half of people die. But I thought I was a very lucky man. And then I was told to stay at home, not to move for a while. Also, because of the COVID, everybody was staying at home, so I had no temptations, and no friends to go to meet for drinks. So I spent almost a whole year watching all Japanese movies, all Russian movies, all expressionist movies. So in some ways, it was like reliving my own youth when I was watching 1-2 movies a day.
Yeah, my dad had an operation during the pandemic, and I was saying to him, it's kind of the perfect time to be recovering, because as you say, there's not much temptation out there. No one's luring you out or distracting you. So that worked out nicely, I guess, in some weird way.
And the good thing with eBay, you can buy like secondhand copies of all movies on Blu-ray for the sale of their price. So I was receiving 1 or 2 DVDs or Blu-rays every morning, and then...
I love it. What sticks with you as standing out from that period of movie watching? Are there any films that come to mind that were particularly influential or hit you?
Oh, yeah. I discovered some directors that I almost didn't know at all.
Yeah.
Like Mizoguchi.
Yeah.
And also Naruse. And there is another one that's almost unknown in the Western world called Kinoshita, who did the original version of The Ballad of Narayama, who's Japanese master that for some weird reason is not as recognized as all the other Japanese masters. Yeah. And I also watch every single movie that exists of Dreyer. I started watching Kiarostami. When you write movies, it takes you a lot of time. So you know there are some missing pieces in your cinematic culture. And I had many pieces missing. Like, for example, I had never seen Andrei Rublev by Tarkovsky. And that's another incredible masterpiece that I had missed for years and years.
Yeah. Did those films influence Vortex then? Because Vortex is very different from anything you've done before. Pace-wise, visually, everything about it, it's very...
I also had to deal with many close deaths during the year. 2020, three very close men died around me. The actor of my first feature, I Stand Alone, Fernando Solanas, the Argentinian film director, who was like an uncle for me, but also I had been his assistant on many movies, assistant director, and he was like a second father for me, and then also the father of Lucille. So I saw three men who were like... almost as close as my father dying in a row, and I saw their funerals. So, I was impregnated by what death is and what the arrow of time is when I started this movie.
Yeah, what struck me about this movie compared to maybe your other movies is the split screen nature of it means it's equally as unflinching and unescapable, but at a far slower pace. And I think that, particularly with the pandemic and when we experience death and loss in life, it is that. It's not this quick highlight that we often see in films. It can be this long, drawn out, either the lead up to death or the feelings after. It's not just a flashing moment. So was that the plan there, to kind of say, look, I want people to sit with the realities of this, you know?
Yeah, I think the timing of the scenes is a real timing. The fact that it's in a split screen, like if their lives were separate while they're living in the same space under the same roof, makes sense, you know, that they're disconnected. Even more because of the mental disease the woman has. But even in real life, two lives are living under the same roof are like two separate tunnels that can watch each other. Life is a lonely experience. You hit other people. You smile to other people, but you're all alone in your head from the first day until the last day.
Yeah, I love that. And it really highlights that. I've always kind of subscribe to that belief that we're all, as an actor as well, even in the smallest roles, it's that realization that in life we are all the lead in our own film. We're not a background character in our own lives, even if we are just sitting on a bus. And that comes across really beautifully in this, because as you say, we're experiencing two different lives at once, but they're both the lead as such.
Also, at the end of the movie, both lives are personal, so there are experiences that cannot be shared, but also they are erasable. So at the end, lives are erased without having been shared, really. I was talking with some other journalists before, and we're talking about the end of the movie. And it's just like the very end of the movie is like if the footprints that these people could have left also disappear. One thing is your memory. The memory disappears when you're dead, or it can even disappear before if you lose your mind. But after losing the memory and losing your life, then also your footprints can disappear almost as soon.
Yeah. And so another thing that's happened to you in recent years is getting sober. I assume was that in reaction to the hospitalization, or
in my case?
Yeah, in your case.
I got sober. My only addiction was partying, drinking and partying and drinking. But for many years, I was going out every night, drinking screwdrivers, meeting people, chatting. But at a certain point, when I was shooting Enter the Void, I started having blackouts from time to time. And said, oh, that's weird, because I was in the club and I woke up in my hotel room or at my place. I don't know how I came back. And they said, oh, this is getting like shaky. But so I started reducing the amount of vodka that I was drinking.
Yeah.
But still, lately, I was told, after what happened to you, you have to protect yourself. So I totally stopped smoking. I stopped drinking white alcohol, like gin, vodka. Mm-hmm. And I even stopped putting salt in my food. But it's kind of weird to not drink while you're having dinner. So I keep on drinking with the meals all the time. But I know if it's not serenity, I don't know if it's maturity, but it's just like you want to live long. And my father, for example, he's 88 years old, and he's hyper creative at his age. So I'd be happy to be 90-95 without any brain damage.
You have to
be careful.
Exactly that. You've maybe got what you need to get from those years. I know, like, I don't particularly do any drugs anymore, but all the drugs I did in my youth have influenced who I am today, are a big part of my art and everything else.
Yeah.
But I don't need to keep doing that.
Also, you get bored.
You get bored. But also, I've seen people have a really bad time on these things. I had a good time on them, so I kind of felt this is a good time to stop, because I've not had the fucked up bit yet. I've not had the damage of it yet. So I guess, how much has that lifestyle influenced your films and your creations over the years?
I know that I stopped marijuana, for example, or marijuana grass and hashish, very young, because when I was 15, probably I discovered it. And at the age of 20, I was turning so paranoid every time I would smoke. So I totally stopped. And then I started trying other things, and I started enjoying alcohol. But yeah, so drugs and chemicals shift a lot. So they can amuse you for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And on the fourth year, you just don't want to see them again. Like a good friend who turned into a bad friend. You just cross the street when you see the other guy's face around the corner.
Yeah, it's weird how these things affect different people, because I'm exactly the same there. I stopped doing weed at least 10 years before I stopped doing hallucinogens, because weed didn't agree with me in that way, whereas hallucinogens did. And then alcohol, still similar. It sticks around every now and then for meals or whatnot. But again, it's how your relationship changes with these things, I guess.
Being curious in life is good, but being compulsive is not good. So every time I could try something in a safe context with the right people, I would try it. But I never put myself in risk with any chemical or any plant.
Do you think that sensible curiosity influenced the kind of excess that a lot of your films explore? Like Irreversible, Enter the Void, obviously Climax as well, all explore some kind of excess or addiction. So do you think there's a fascination there because of your own kind of control in life?
It's probably because I enjoy being with people who are curious.
Yeah.
And curious people can be considered excessive. Now, most of the people I portray in my movies are the kind of people that I hang out with in real life.
Yeah.
Besides the rapist in Irreversible.
Yeah. Besides that guy. But other than that, I want to kind of ask, as I've said, I'm a big fan of your work, and I've personally felt enjoyment from seeing Irreversible the first time in a cinema. I've consciously seeked out screenings each time, because watching in the cinema is a different experience. Mm. Do you have any preference or preciousness over where and how people watch your films or enjoy your films, or do you just kind of, you like them just watching if they want to?
Of course, it's always funner to watch movies on a big screen, but sometimes you're not able to go to see it at the BFI when it's playing, or you're not in a mood to cross the whole city to spend 90 minutes in a movie theater and spend another 90 minutes to go back to your place. So sometimes it feels much better to watch the movies at home, because you find the right timing for the experience. Have you seen my second edit of Irreversible?
No, I've only seen the original release.
Because it was released on Blu-ray in England. I did a new cut that is chronological instead of the original.
Right, wow.
The new one is clockwise and the other one was anti-chronological.
Yeah.
But I think they're going to be playing the new cut on a big screen at the BFI when they'll be doing my retrospective. So if you want to see it in a very new way, come to see it at the BFI. It's at the beginning of May.
I'll have to catch that. How was that to put together? Because one of the most beautiful things about Irreversible, because of that edit, was it's got a happy ending, but that's what makes it heartbreaking, because it's not the ending, it's the beginning. It's heightened in the heartbreak, because you kind of go, oh, it's beautiful, and then it sinks in that you're like, ah, fuck. That makes everything that's happened previously in our timeline even worse. So how was that to put it together with a brutal ending, I guess?
There is another movie that I did that doesn't have a happy ending, but it kind of looks like a happy ending. It's Lux Aeterna, the 52-minute piece I did.
Yeah.
Because it's about the shooting of a film about witches. And on the set, everything goes wrong. But at the end, accidentally, there's some technical problem with the lighting. And at the end, what the camera is shooting looks great. So finally, the movie that they're shooting that was supposed to be a total artistic shit becomes a masterpiece just because there is a technical problem on the set.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the last images are incredible.
I can't think of the film it made me think of. Oh man, that's going to kill me, because they're doing a remake of it at the moment as well, which I don't think would be good. But there's a particular I'm sure it's a French film, maybe it's a German film that is all about the making of an avant-garde film and all the way through.
Or is it La Nuit Américaine by Truffaut?
Yeah.
The American Night by Truffaut? There was a French movie with Jacqueline Bisset.
No, I don't think it is that. Essentially, all the way through, you're kind of getting the impression that this avant-garde film is going to be shit. And then when they actually show a part of it in the film, it's astounding. And it's kind of, I can't,
I don't know.
It's going to annoy me because I'm sure you will have been aware of it because it's a bit of a classic. But did making Lux Aeterna inform Vortex because of the split screen nature and things like that of representing two things at once and realizing how much you can have going on? You don't have to have one go boring while this is happening here. You can kind of keep both.
No, mostly nowadays I like shooting fast and without a script. When I shoot Climax, I shoot it in 15 days, which is nothing.
Yeah.
With a 7-page script. And then I shot Lux Aeterna in 5 days with the 3 lines. And then so I said, well, for this new one, Vortex, if I write 10 pages, it's already too much. I'd rather create the movie on the set with the actors that have agreed to play in the movie. So, yeah, I want to get the money to rent the cameras, to have my crew, to have the location, buy some clothes and have the actors that I would like to party with. And then let's start the party let's make some valuable out of the party.
I love it because it shows the collaborative nature. Sophia Obertella is a friend of mine, and the year that Climax came out, she had numerous really big projects out that year, but Climax was the one that she was most invested in and excited. Like, I'll often text after one of her films, be like, oh, that was great, but Climax was one, because she knows I'm a fan of you as well. That she was like, I want to know what you think of this. Because, again, as you say, it was essentially a 15-day party that then became this piece of art. And the beautiful thing there for me was seeing so many people who didn't know that Sophia was a dancer, a refugee, a dancer, all of these things prior to a Hollywood-type star. How was that to kind of, as you say, not have much of a script, not have much of a pitch document, and just say, do you want to come and make a film?
No, I think that you have to pre-produce a movie in an instinctive way. You have to find the right people who are creative, who are inventive, who are easy to work with.
Yeah.
And then bring them all together and then create whatever can be created collectively. And then the director always has the final word, because then in the editing room you can get rid of anything that you dislike and you just keep the whatever you liked that is in the can. So I'm not worried. No, when I shoot, I think shooting feature films that are narrative is like also like shooting documentaries. Bring as much material as you can to your editing room, and then there's a second part of the creative process that is selecting the right moments that are recorded in the can.
Yeah,
and
I love that.
Getting rid of whatever is not as good. So when you start editing, you don't know if the movie is going to last 80 minutes or 2 hours and 40 minutes. And it's like a baby that has its own needs. No, the baby says, oh, please take this thing out of me. And so some scenes that you like shooting don't work in the edit. So you just pull them out of the box so the baby can breathe.
I love it. And I love the one of my favorite things, I come from music. I was a rapper for years, and in music, I was in control of everything. I directed all my videos, I'd sort my tours and all that. So moving into acting, one of the things I love is the lack of control, the panic, the finishing a shoot and coming away going, well, that might turn out to be shit, or it might turn out to be amazing, because it's then in your hands. So how do you find that kind of that responsibility to put all these people together, to get all the footage, and then they have to know that it's out of their control now? It's all what you find in that.
Yeah, it's also, people also know very quickly that any good idea they can bring might be there for forever. So it's at a point, like, even the actors, the technicians start competing to see who has the funniest idea to bring or to propose to the director, who then accepts it or not. And then I don't like feeling that I'm working.
Yeah.
So and the best way to not have that feeling that you're working is just to hire people that you would go for holidays with. For example, I always loved having lunch or dinner with Dario. I say, oh, if I can have Dario, the lunchtime during the shooting is going to be funny because he has so many stories to tell you. I discovered that he was hanging out in Germany with Fassbinder. I said, I can't believe you know Fassbinder. And then also François Rebrun had so many stories about Jean Eustache that I admire. And then, and Benoît Deby, my permanent cinematographer that I love, also had so many stories of his other shootings that even while you're working, you're waiting for the lunchtime or the dinner time so you can talk about other things than just the movie itself.
I'd make up a project if it meant I got to hear obscure Fassbinder stories in the lunch breaks. That's absolutely insane. How was it working with Dario then? Because obviously he's a legend of cinema, and I think you've got some shared language in the films you make, to not sound too poncy with it. The vibrance, the colours, the wanting to bring excitement onto the screen. Mm. How was it to work with him? And on a project like this, which isn't necessarily about vibrance and colour and flashing. Mm. It's about a muted relationship.
I think if it was not because he had seen my previous movies.
Yeah.
And for example, I met him when I was showing Carne, my first short film in Toronto. And he said, oh, can I help you to produce your feature film? Then I did I Stand Alone that he saw. Then when I was editing Irreversible, he came to Paris and he came to my editing room. So I had shown him the first half of Irreversible while I was editing. And then like every 2 years we would meet, or every year we would meet in some festival or in Paris or in Rome. So it's like a long term friendship that finally concluded in working together. It all felt very natural, but when I told him I have this idea for this movie, it's a sad movie, it's not a horror movie, because he really liked Climax also, and he was kind of worried when he saw Love. He said, well, why is Gaspar doing porn now? So he would have expected me to propose him something like Climax or like Irreversible or Enter the Void, probably, but not this movie, because also he feels very young and say, well, what's this movie about an old couple? Like, I'm young. And say, yeah, of course you're young. Yeah, you're very young. So I just want you to play this old man, you young Dario. And I said, okay. And then he put a condition, but I like to have in the story a mistress. And I said, okay, of course, we'll find you a mistress. And finally, it ended up being the girl who was taking care of the wardrobe, the stylist of the shooting, who played the part. But it's like, it's a small part. But I said, you have to create your own character. My script is just 10 pages long, but also because it has big letters, with a normal typography, it would be 5 pages long. So you create your character. I do the camera. I operate the camera. You do your job. I do mine. And Frances will do her job. And let's make a good movie together. So, and he said, and the dialogues, I said, of course, I'm not going to give you dialogues. You're much better for talking than I am for writing dialogues. So I said, okay, well, let's do it. And so he came to Paris. We were supposed to shoot the movie in 4 weeks, but finally it took 5 weeks, but he left 1 week before the end. So, yeah, that's how we did the movie.
I love it. The way you speak of making films, there must be a level of confidence on your part that you're going to be able to make something good. Every time in my music career, every time I finished an album, I'd be thinking in the back of my head, I've got away with that. I've not got another one in me. I don't know where that all came from, but it's there and it's good. So that's wicked. But it doesn't feel like it's anything to do with me. So to shoot with that kind of feeling of, oh, we'll shoot it or I'll put it together. And then, in my opinion, they've all worked out really good. So is there ever any doubt that you're putting it together and going, oh, shit, it's not working?
But also, for example, if you have to cut scenes, of course, sometimes in my previous movies, there are scenes that were not as good as the other ones. Take them off. And if the movie is too short at the end, you can always invent scenes with just titled cards, or you can invent something that you shoot in one day that would make the movie that it's a, that is 70 minutes long, 75, you'll find an idea to make it longer. But
you figure it out.
What you mostly see when you see movies, that you feel the energy that was going through the set during the shooting.
Yeah, I think that's why Climax was my favourite of your films on that first watch. And I've got a bit of a theory on your films. So I'm not going to tell you about how you make films. But it's obviously you present a load of different topics and subjects and visuals with each film. But it feels like each film you kind of are obsessing on one topic. So with Irreversible, it feels like it was revenge. With Love, as Dario said, it's sex. You're making porn all of a sudden. And with Enter the Void, it felt like it was consciousness. But with Climax, it felt like it was dance. Those were the bits that you would kind of lose yourself in the most in these films. But with Vortex, that obsession seems to me to be compassion and how hard that can be over long term with illness, with all sorts of different things. Compassion is seen as this simple, oh, I have love for you, I love you. And it's far more complex than that. It's, as we see with the characters, there becomes resentment, there becomes all of these things.
It seems like in my movie, it seems like maturity could bring to wisdom, but most of the time, it goes directly to senility instead.
Exactly.
So from maturity to senility, and where's the wisdom?
Yeah, you get to skip the wisdom part. It's like, hang on, I was waiting for that moment.
And then to disappearance.
yeah, exactly. I mean, you put it perfectly in the beginning. I made note of it. The dedication to all those whose brains will decompose before their hearts. Yeah, how is that as a subject to explore? Because it is relentlessly raw, an emotion and a subject.
On the set, the mood was excellent. Every member of the crew had parents of the same age than Dario and Francois. So everybody on the set was relating to this story because half of them were already dealing with some illness on the mother's or father's side. We're dependent of our parents, and at a certain point, what's surprising is when they become dependent of us.
Yeah.
That's
parent
how
parent in your parents as such.
How that's how life goes.
Do you as you mature as such, do you find yourself thinking more and more about that journey towards death?
I saw this from very close 2 years ago.
Yeah, and exactly.
Hopefully, I was given like a lucky ticket. So my life was extended without brain damage, or it was first extended, and then it was extended without brain damage. So I said, "Well, that's such a nice gift that destiny gave me. Let's enjoy it as much as humanly possible." So I'm trying to be sweet to myself in order to last long, because on other hands, because I have this like a survivor's feeling, and I've seen other friends who almost died who survived, then you're less afraid of death, even nowadays with this fear of the atomic bombs falling on our heads. I see people that are really freaking out, and I've seen many movies, some good ones, about what's going to be the Third World War, like Threats, you know, this BBC movie from 1984, and I don't stop thinking about it. So, probably it's going to be a very scary experience, but we could live it. It's going to be a terrifying experience, and at the end we'll die, and die is just nothing. So, but for many people, death is an unnatural thing. For me, death is the most natural thing.
Yeah, I've got a stammer, and I got that because of almost dying as a kid, and I think that and my parents just kind of openly talking about death. When I started doing music and that, my albums came out, and all the reviews were about how morbid a lot of it was, and I didn't know it was morbid. I had no idea. I was like, oh, no, we just, like, death's a thing. That's what we're all going to do. But I think the thing that's scarier, and again is addressed in Vortex, is scarier than death is growing old. And the thing that it struck me in Vortex is growing old before you're ready to grow old, before you're ready to become that person, and the struggle to accept age, the struggle to accept deterioration, whether it be mental or physical. And that's where the darkness comes, I guess, the kind of scariness, rather than simply the threat of death. It's the threat of not dying, if that makes sense. So, yeah, how was that to explore?
But in many ways, I felt I was more fearful when I was younger.
Yeah.
Because the idea of dying or being crippled scared me much more. I've lived a life already, and yeah, there's some tranquility that comes with age.
Yeah.
Sometimes, in my case, at least.
One of the things, in general, I like an empty cinema, but again, with your films, I like to be in a crowd, and one of the reasons for that is your credits tend to be quite quiet and gentle. So that moment when the lights come up and we're all kind of confronted with what we've all just experienced, again, you do push a lot of impactful stuff into your film. So kind of how important is finding the right place of discomfort in the viewer's experience? Is that something that you enjoy to explore? From my days of standing on stage on my own, I reveled in the moments of awkwardness and silence and discomfort. And I think that's why I enjoy that post-film moment so much. Is that a key thing for you in emotion you want to elicit?
You're not trying to bring people to a discomfort zone, like other directors can bring their audience to a comfort zone.
Yeah.
It's just once you've chosen your subject, if it's a tearful subject, make it tearful. If it's a sexy subject, make it sexy. Just try to reproduce or imitate the feeling that those situations have in real life. And in this case, it's a movie about aging and passing away. That's the subject. Yeah. So try to reproduce the energy that comes with those situations.
You've spoken many times before. Again, you touched on the rape scene in Irreversible earlier, and again, I felt when that started to cause some kind of uproar, it was beautifully put. You kind of we're meant to feel discomfort if we're watching something as horrific as rape, and that kind of continues across your films.
The weird thing about Irreversible, sometimes it was men who felt more uncomfortable with the rape scene, and not only because they felt weird or because they were thinking of their daughter, their girlfriend that could happen to them, but also I found out that many guys came to me in a respectful or in a hateful way because they had been raped themselves. And say, well, I have never seen this, but it was weird because I remember being in a nightclub and a guy said, well, you're lucky that I just meet you now, because if I had met you just after watching Irreversible, it would smash your face. And I say, why? It's because of the rape scene. I say, oh, yeah, well, at least you can. It was portrayed in a way that touched you, so you can know what it could feel like. Yeah, but I had been raped by the best friend of my father during my whole youth, so I didn't need to see that again and again.
Yeah,
and so, I was surprised because the guy was much taller than me, that much stronger, and he looked like a bodyguard. But rape is everywhere in the society.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've spoken of the improvisation and the kind of working it out as you're there, the 5-page scripts or 10-page, depending on the font. How much preparation do you put into the big dramatic scenes? Because again, on that scene, one of the beautiful things about it is the camera being static on the floor rather than putting us as part of it. It forces us to observe.
Yeah, but also if the camera is static because the victim, who's played by Monica Bellucci, is static. She's not active. She cannot escape. So it would have made no sense to shake the camera, because then either you would have felt that you're reproducing the aggressor's point of view, or you would have been like the camera of a camera operator getting excited. So it wouldn't have been respectful to what the situation was.
Yeah. How was it? Like, Irreversible was kind of what really launched you on a global platform, it felt like. How was it after that had happened? Like, did you feel pressure? Did you feel under extra scrutiny? Like, how was it to suddenly have, as said, a global platform for your films?
Mostly, that movie that I didn't expect to be a commercial success was a commercial success.
Yeah.
Although it was very violent, it was like number one French movie in Turkey, in Greece, in Venezuela, and even in France, it did extremely well. It sold like 600,000 tickets, and it was sold to every country, and it was very well accepted compared to what I expected from such a movie. So hopefully that movie that was made almost like a bank robbery, that was suddenly planned, allowed me to then get one day into the pre-production of Enter the Void. That was my dream project. And when I did Enter the Void, it took me 6 years to raise the money, to pre-produce it, to shoot it, to edit it, to do the visual effects and to release it. So it was exhausting. And with Enter the Void, I made my producers lose a lot of money. But the movie now has a cult following, especially among teenagers who are discovering the mushrooms and other chemicals. But when it came out, it was not commercially successful at all. Since then, I'm trying to do cheap movies, fastly done, because I don't have the energy to spend 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years on one single movie.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. With that kind of cult following and things like that, also comes a greater analysis. With Enter the Void, I came to a screening that you were doing a Q&A afterwards, and I got the feeling that you were quite quickly growing tired of people over analyzing, speaking of the art of everything, and a lot of stuff you were kind of like, I just thought it'd look cool. Or over-intellectualizing is the word I'm looking for. How have you found that? Because, again, I've always felt David Lynch fans, for example, I feel David Lynch can do anything. His fans will figure out the meaning, and he can then go, that's what I meant to do. Yep, you've nailed it. And you kind of beautifully rally against that. When people do put extra worth or meaning on, you will quite happily turn around and go, no, I just thought it'd look cool to be coming out of a penis and doing this or doing that or whatever else it may be.
But especially, that's a big problem with the Anglo-Saxon world and the Muslim world also, is that penis is seen as the face of the devil. It's not the same in France, in Italy, in Denmark, or in Switzerland, like where penis is like a hand or a vagina or a nose or an ear. It's just a part of the body that is more useful for reproduction, but there's nothing shameful about it. But I remember promoting, for example, Love in the United States, and I had this question much more often than in England. Why did you need to show a penis and say, hey, my penis was one of my favorite parts of my body, so why wouldn't I show a penis on screen? It looks good. It's like a nose or whatever. Please don't ask stupid questions. It's a movie about passion. And also, when I did that that shot in Enter the Void where you see a fecundation, I just thought it was the most normal way to show fecundation.
Yeah.
Where do we come from? We come from a penis that drops some liquid inside a cavern. It's
perfect, yeah. it makes sense. So before I wrap things up, I want to kind of ask what you watch, or if there's anything recent, if there are any directors or writers or anything recently that you are enjoying. I know as you said, you went on a big binge of classic Russian cinema and various other areas. Is there anything from recent times that kind of excites you? Is there anyone you're a fan of?
No, among the young generations, there's one director from America that makes me laugh so much. It's Todd Solondz.
Right. Yeah.
I've seen Palindromes 10 times at least, and also the black humor of Ulrich Seidel in his movie Paradise Love makes me crazy also. Probably I've seen Paradise Love 10 times, and it makes me laugh each time.
Yeah, I love it.
And you know, I know, which I'm totally fascinated also by another like Hollywood movie, Gravity.
Yeah.
I saw it in 3D in France once, twice. I even bought the German 3D Blu-ray to watch it in German so I could see the movie without paying attention to the dialogues. Yeah. Then when I had my brain hemorrhage, I was sent to the hospital and they told me, oh, you'll probably die in the next 4 or 5 days, but probably not so well. On the sixth day, they were playing Gravity on TV, and it was a very small TV set on the other side of my hospital room. And it was a tiny square TV with the image inside, and it was playing with in a French dub version. But I was so full of morphine, and I was kind of happy to be surviving to the fifth day, whatever. And I watched that, and it was probably my most psychedelic movie experience in my life, because I felt like the whole room was turning around the TV, and yeah. I felt like I was Sandra Bullock myself trying to survive in space. And I had so much fun rewatching the movie for the ninth time.
Watching Gravity on morphine sounds like Enter the Void. That sounds like what you would get there. Yeah, the movement and the discomfort of it all.
But the TV set was a very small one on the other side of the room. But I was drunk, but also when you're really focused on the movie, I felt like it was a wide screen around me.
And also
I felt like it was a room that was moving all around the TV set, up and down. And it was so true. Creepy that he put me in a good mood, and then I survived.
I love it. Saved by Sandra Bullock, officially.
Saved by Alfonso Cuarón.
Before we go, this interview came up last minute, and I was watching your Criterion video before this, and I grabbed a couple of films that you recommended on that from my DVD collection, and one that I was really glad you mentioned was Seconds,
yeah.
What is it about that you enjoyed? Because it feels like it's influential in its kind of relentless ability to just push reality, to push linear narrative. What do you enjoy about Seconds?
I know it's dreamy and very realistic at the same time.
Yeah.
It's about someone getting to another dimension and trying to survive in it. In some ways, it reminds me of Videodrome, although Videodrome is more K. Dickian than Seconds. But it's someone who's trying to do a new life by changing his face, and he gets into a new society, and inside that is a kind of call for people who escape from their past. I know there's something that really works in that movie, and it's by far my favorite movie of John Frankenheimer, who did quite an amount of good movies.
Rock Hudson in it, learning later what he was going through with his sexuality and all this kind of thing, it adds a depth to that film as well. That desire to go to another place and be who you truly are, but then being pulled back by people going, oh no, hang on, I know who you are, and people from your past. It's beautiful, right? I love shit like that.
It's a movie that turns you paranoid. There are not many movies that really turn you paranoid. Repulsion is another one. Repulsion by Polanski.
Yeah.
You don't need to smoke a joint to turn paranoid by watching it. Seconds. Neither.
Completely. The other one you mentioned is Sundays and Sibyl. That I really enjoyed. And again, I'm probably trying to force comparisons here, but it made me think of Vortex because of that. It feels like it's all about the value that's added when a limitation is put on interaction, on relationships. They've really got a limit, and then it's the difference between the inside world and the outside world's perception of these relationships. So yeah, what is it about that film that you enjoy?
I thought it was extremely sweet and intelligent, and also said that there are many movies about a man who has a or an older person having a friendly, motherly, fatherly relationship with someone younger, that is accused of being a child abuser or a pedophile who's not. There are a few movies with those kind of subjects, but this one is so touching and so much more poetic than the other ones I've seen.
Yeah.
And then you really can tell that the guy's only purpose to raise his guilt of having killed a young girl, and so he just wants to be a good father to someone. But it's how people perceive, especially in France, Germans were not very well perceived
until a few years ago in France in the 60s, a German was a Nazi.
Yeah.
And the main character, for people who don't know this movie, it's about a German pilot in France who has an attraction for a girl who's in a school, and this girl is not being taken care of by her parents, so she becomes friends with this German pilot, and nothing happens, but everybody thinks that he's twisted, and he's not being twisted. He just wants to raise his guilt for having killed once a girl in a war accidentally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate your time, so I'll let you go now. Before we do, what's ahead? Now you've not died,
let's what's hope. Next? What's next? Let's see if the missiles are coming or not.
Yeah.
But for the moment, I'm doing the promotion of the movie, and I cross fingers that no one presses the red button. Then we can keep on talking about the future.
100%. Yeah. The future is next, hopefully. Well, I appreciate your time, and it's been a pleasure to chat. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I clearly did. Seeing Gaspar's smiling little face throughout that was an absolute joy. Beaming back at me from the computer screen was an absolute joy. I didn't know how he'd be. He's, you know, he's an artist. I've seen him be interviewed before and kind of never, like, cut anyone off or anything, but, you know, not appreciate when people have over-intellectualized or whatever else his stuff. So you may have heard some nerves in there, but allow it. It's my favorite director, and it was on a number of hours' notice. It was that morning, and they were like, "You up for this later?" So, yeah, amazing. Do go and check out the chat with Sophia Botella. That's one of my favorite ones. I've probably referenced it a lot because there was a few stories in it that really inspired me as I moved into acting, and continue to. Her chat and the first Stephen Graham chat. There's been many Stephen Graham chats. They're all amazing. But her chat and the first two-parter with Davey are two that have helped me an awful lot in the acting world. So, yeah, anyway, I'm going to shut up. I'll be back next week. I'm always back. I've been back every week for, what, are we on 7 years now? 8 years? 9 years? Every Wednesday. Sometimes twice a week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.